Questions? So Griffith's plan is to go through a bunch of examples, so when we do the general case, you'll have kind of something to see how things fit together. In the previous two examples, we had oscillation between two turning points, and we had a discrete set of energy levels labeled by a whole number. And we have a different situation when we have a free particle, right? Their classical allowed region is all of space, and there are no turning points. And kind of see how that works out. So the time-independent Schrodinger equation is, you know, your favorite differential equation. Psi double prime is proportional to minus psi. So we generally get sines and cosines, but we decide to write these things as e to the I kx. And of course, there are two solutions, e to the I kx and e to the minus I kx, but we'll put them all together and just think about k as being both positive and negative. Positive k corresponds to things that are going to positive x, negative k corresponds to things that are going in negative x. And of course, the energy isn't going to depend on whether k is positive or negative. And that all makes sense, right? If you have the same speed, but you're going this way or that way, you have the same kinetic energy. So in order to look at moving particles, we want the time-dependent Schrodinger's equation. And to do that, we use separation of variables. We pick one of these solutions, and we tack on this time dependence. And we get something that looks, I hope, super familiar from E and M, e to the I kx minus omega t. And that corresponds to a wave that has a phase velocity that is omega over k, and a group velocity, d omega dk, which when we calculate it out, better give us the classical velocity, and in fact it does. Now, what we've done in the past is to kind of solve an initial value problem. If we wanted to have some wave function that was specified as f of x, we would write it as a superposition of these eigenfunctions, and we would find these expansion coefficients by Fourier's trick because these guys were orthogonal. And Fourier series is going to do us exactly the same thing, and I hope you see that it is the same thing. So because we have states that are indexed by whole numbers here, we have a sum. Here we have states that are indexed by a real number, so we have an integral. These g of k play the role of the c, and this thing here is the wave function that we're taking superpositions of. And of course, to make time-dependent things, we just tack on the e to the minus I omega t. To figure out what these expansion coefficients are, what we do is we do this dot product and integral, and I hope you can see that that's what we've got, right? Psi has been complex conjugated, we're multiplying it by f of x and integrating to get that result. There's some kind of surprising things that are going to give us a little bit of concern in the future. These wave functions are not normalizable, right? Psi star psi is a constant every place in space. And that turns out to be what you're forced to have, right? By Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, this has a definite energy, so it has a definite momentum, so it has to have a fully indefinite position. So it has to be every place. But if it's every place, you can't normalize it. And we did see kind of odd statement that by taking a linear combination of things that are not normalizable, we can make a blob that is normalizable, and that thing can happily propagate away. Kind of in terms of terminology, cases like this where the energy can be a real number, we call those continuous energies. Cases where we have energy that's labeled by whole numbers, we call that discrete energy. Questions? Okay, so example four is a very unrealistic potential. It's useful for a few things, but at least it's moderately easy once you get used to how delta functions work. And we talked about delta functions in E&M, but I'm sure you don't remember everything I said last semester. So might be worth remembering the basic ideas. So the delta function is this odd guy that is zero every place except where its argument is zero. So if I have delta of x minus a, it's zero every place except at a. And at a, it's so tall that the area under it is equal to 1. Okay, so this thing is 0 except at, when I write it like this, at x equals 0 in general where its argument is 0, but the integral over any small region that includes that point is equal to 1. And it's going to be helpful to kind of make a stack of integration and differentiation. We did this last semester too. So let me define the theta function as the integral from minus infinity to x of delta of y dy. And I hope it's clear, if x is less than 0, then we never hit the point where the delta function is singular, so we're going to get 0. If x is more than 0, then we'll go through the singular point and this thing will be 1. So, you know, kind of, you can't sketch something that is 0 every place except at a point, but that's kind of what you think about a delta function of. This theta function is then a step function. Okay, so there's no name for this function. I'm just going to call it eta to give it a name, but let's do the same thing for the theta function. Okay, so obviously if x is less than 0, then we're integrating lots of 0, so this thing is going to be 0. Once we hit this region, then we're going to add area underneath it in linear proportion to where we are. I don't know. We can go one more if we want. And this thing would be quadratic. And what's important to remember, I've done this by integration, but differentiation is the reverse process. So if I take the derivative of the theta function, I'm going to get the delta function, right? The derivative is 0 here, it's 0 here, but the derivative is infinite there. So that all makes pretty good sense. The derivative is 0 here, the derivative is 1 here. So we go down this stack the way I wrote it by integration, we go up this stack by differentiation. Okay, so if we have a delta function potential, and we're going to have attractive potential, so I'm going to write the potential energy as minus alpha of x, then we're going to have the differential equation that minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to x of psi, minus alpha psi is a constant called energy times psi. And on the right-hand side, there's no delta function. There's nothing that's singular about that function. So on the left-hand side, there must be some way that we can cancel that delta function. It must be that when we take derivatives of psi, we're going to generate a canceling delta function. And you can see what's required then is that the wave function has to have a discontinuous slope. The next example after this, we have potentials that instead of being delta functions, have theta functions. And you can see under those circumstances, then we're going to have wave functions that have a continuous value and slope, but have a discontinuous curvature, second derivative. Okay, so far so good. The way we're going to, let's start to solve this by looking at the spot where x isn't equal to 0. In which case, the solution to the differential equation is pretty easy. We've got h double prime squared over 2m psi double prime is equal to the energy. And that's exactly the differential equation we had over here. But we're really looking for solutions that are bound. That is to say, that have an energy that's less than zero. We'll look at the other solutions too, but let's look at solutions where the energy is less than zero. Okay, so if this is negative and this is negative, then that means we have the differential equation that is psi double prime is equal to plus psi. So we've got minus 2me divided by h bar squared psi. And I'm saying that this thing is going to be positive. I'm looking for solutions where that thing is positive. And so I'm going to call this kappa. Kappas look exactly like k's on the board. Sorry about that. The Greek letter kappa, that's Griffith's choice. Okay, well, I don't know, pretty easy differential equation. We've got a solution that is e to the plus kappa times x and e minus kappa times x. And separately, neither of those two things look normalizable, right? E to the plus x gets big as x goes to plus infinity, and e to the minus x gets big as x goes to minus infinity. But we don't have to have a continuous function. We can have a discontinuous slope. So we can use this guy on the x greater than 0 piece, and we can use this guy on the x less than 0 piece, and just connect them up with a discontinuity in slope right at x equals 0. Well, let's see if that works. So how do I relate the discontinuity in slope to this differential equation? And the answer is by integrating the differential equation. So let's integrate this differential equation from a little bit before the delta function to a little bit after the delta function. The antiderivative of the second derivative is going to be the first derivative. So we're going to get minus h bar squared over 2m, the first derivative of psi evaluated at this point, minus the first derivative of psi evaluated at the previous point. The integral of the delta function is going to be 1 times the value of the function at that location. And maybe I should remind you of that general result. It's one of the homework problems that if you're integrating a function like this, and we know that the delta function is 0 except when x equals a, so this thing is equal to the integral from just before a to just after a of f of x delta of x minus a. And of course, over that tiny region, f of x is just the constant f of a. And we know that the integral of the delta function is 1. So this is a very commonly used result for delta functions, that if you integrate any old function, you just get the value of the function where the delta function is 0. Excuse me, where the argument of the delta function is 0, where the delta function is singular. Here, for an arbitrarily small region, there's no area under the curve. Okay. At some point we're going to want to change variables, but maybe not yet. Continue to hang on to this kind of ugly. Oh wait. Nope. Hang on to these things for a second longer. Okay, so the trial solution we're going to have is that psi is equal to some constant e to the plus kappa x when x is negative, and it's equal to a e to the minus kappa x when x is positive. And we do have to have a, so this is where we are. We do have to have a continuous value for the function. So that's why I've chosen the same thing, the same constant a, so that psi doesn't have a discontinuous value, it just has a discontinuous slope. Okay, so if I plug and chug this through, I've got minus h bar squared over 2m, and then I want psi for positive x. I want to take the derivative of that and evaluate it at 0. So I'm going to get a minus kappa and then a times 1. When I take the derivative of this, it has a positive slope. And of course, the value of the function psi at 0 is equal to a. So you can see that the overall normalization constant A is going to cancel out. And what we're going to get then, we got all these minus signs canceling out. We have a 2 here that's canceling out. So we get h bar squared kappa divided by m has to equal alpha. And what we're interested in is the value of kappa. So kappa is equal to m alpha over h bar squared. And that means that the energy, where did we define all that? So here's the energy. The energy is equal to minus h bar squared kappa squared divided by 2m. I'm going to have a lot of h bars here. So kappa is m alpha over h bar squared. So we're going to get 1m. Two alphas, a minus sign, and a 2 in the denominator, and then an h bar squared in the denominator. And that's the only solution. So we only have one of these confined states. There is no, before we had lots of states specified by an infinite class of whole numbers. Now we just have one bound state that's specified by that result. Okay, and we could figure out, to normalize this, we could figure out what the value of capital A is, but that's easily done. Okay, so one bound state, one state that has finite size. How about the other states? How about the states where energy is greater than zero? Well, same differential equation. And if we rewrite the differential equation, we have psi double prime is equal to minus 2m energy divided by h bar squared times psi. This is now a positive number. Let me call it k squared, just exactly as we did before. And so we have solutions of the form e to the I kx and e to the minus I kx. But we have to worry some about that delta function. And there are a variety of solutions that we could work with, but what I'm going to particularly want to consider is a solution of the following form. So other forms are possible, but this is, I don't know, kind of the garden variety form. What happens if I shine some electrons in from the left, and therefore I have some wave function that's of that form. And what I expect, of course, is that lots of these things are going to make it through, but some of them may bounce back. Okay, so I could just as well have solutions where I shine things in from the right. I mean, there are all sorts of possibilities, but this is the one that we're going to deal with. And what we're going to be interested in is the reflection probability. What's the probability that the particle is going to bounce back, given that it's aimed at this potential well? So it might be smart to think about this thing classically for a second. If we think about the motion classically, if we shine Newtonian particles in, they would have, there's no force here because the potential is constant, so they would have a constant speed. When they went on top of this delta function, they would have an infinite amount of energy, so I guess they'd have an infinite amount of speed, but they would only have it for a finite period of time. There's no turning point, so there's no reason they would turn back, so they would just go right through. So classically, there would be no reflection. And kind of generically, what you see, well, you see it, you know, in E&M. Where we had reflections was where we had a sharp edge, where we went from one index of refraction to another index of refraction. And that's generically the case. If you have smooth potentials, then you usually don't have reflection. But here we have a sharp sharp, quickly changing, that is to say, sharp potential. And so as a result, there's going to be some reflection. Now, if we were going to do this problem right, what we would do is we would make something that looks like a particle. So we would take a linear combination of these sorts of things, and we'd make some sort of blob. And we could see this blob in part going through and in part being reflected back. And you can do all of that, but it turns out that it's kind of a computational mess. And so instead, what we're kind of going to do is to reinterpret this wave function, which is not normalizable, and instead think about it as a beam of particles, a continuous beam of particles. So how many particles are going by per second with say, this sort of a wave? Well, we can calculate that through from the current density that we calculated before. So I'm sure it's on the tip of your tongues that the current density was equal to h bar over 2mi psi complex conjugate, and then this kind of derivative going this way or that. And we might as well work this through just to do it. But the only thing we really care about at the end of this, and I hope it's obvious right from the start, that these currents are proportional to the corresponding constant squared. Right? So and this is just like it was in E&M, right? The energy was proportional to this coefficient squared. So these coefficients squared are going to give us the amount of reflected light. So in the end, this reflection coefficient is going to be the magnitude of b squared divided by the magnitude of a squared. But just for fun, let's do that once in our life. So we're putting in psi as e to the I kx. And psi star, of course, is a complex conjugate e to the minus I kx. So when I take the derivative of this, I bring down an ik. And I'm going to get e to the minus kx, and then I'm going to get an ik, and then I'm going to get an a e to the plus ikx. Then we're supposed to subtract what happens when the derivative hits the other term, and when the derivative hits the other term, we get bring down a minus ik, And you can see how this is going to work out. These two terms are going to come together. We're going to get a 2ik. The I is going to cancel. The 2 is going to cancel. So we're going to get an h bar k divided by m magnitude of a squared. You might remember that in electricity and magnetism, the current density was the charge per volume times the velocity. And this is the classical velocity, right? Because kh bar is the momentum, and the momentum divided by m is the velocity. And a squared is kind of like the density. So it all kind of makes sense. If we wanted the transmission coefficient, of course, that's going to be the magnitude of c squared divided by a squared. And boy, those things better add up to 1, right? Because there isn't another chance for something to happen. It's either going to reflect or it's going to make it through. Okay, so it looks like, okay, here it is. Well, yeah, here it is. So that's what we got when we integrated the differential equation. And it hasn't changed now that the energy is positive or negative, right? Because if we integrate this over an infinitesimal region, we're still going to get 0. So that's an equation that has to be true. And so what we've got then is for psi, for x less than 0, it's going to be a e to the I kx plus b e to the minus I kx. And here we're going to get c e to the I kx for x greater than 0. So psi prime evaluated at the endpoints, we're going to bring down an ik from this. We plug in x equals 0, we're going to get 1. When we bring this down, we're going to get a minus sign. And same thing here, we're going to get an IKC for x equals 0 plus. We also have to have the value of the function being continuous. So psi itself at x equals 0 minus is going to be a plus b, and x equals 0. And these two things have to agree. Okay, so for this other equation, we've got to use this. So here's the equation we've got. So we've got minus h bar squared 2m. We're supposed to evaluate the derivative of the function at a little bit positive, and what we get is ikc. And we're supposed to subtract off what we put in when we put in a little bit before 0, and we're going to get ika minus b. And this all has to equal minus alpha times the value of the function at 0. And we can choose, take our choice. I'm going to choose the top choice. Okay, two equations, three unknowns, right? A, B, and C. But we only care about the ratio of B to A. So we're still looking good. And we can substitute in that C is equal to A plus B. And we should be okay. So what we've got here is minus h bar squared over 2m. This term is going to cancel. This term is going to add. So we're going to get 2ib. And that's going to all equal alpha times a plus b. Okay. twos are going to go away. And I think what I'm going to want to do is to bring all of these constants over to that other side. So we're going to have, with the minus sign, why not? So we're going to get B is equal to minus M alpha divided by H bar squared, and I drop my K. And I want the I. So the I was up there, so it's going to be down there. And this really is an H bar squared. Well, when we get a bunch of constants like this, it's kind of nice to get some sort of rough physical interpretation for what this constant, you know, kind of really is. So what we had here is kappa was m alpha over h bar squared. So this constant could be written minus 1 is I squared, so I can write this as kappa over k. And I don't know if that means anything to you or not. Let's kind of think physically about what's going on. So the wave function for the bound state was like e to the minus kappa x and plus kappa x, right? Look kind of like this. So kind of a typical size for this thing where it goes down by a factor of e is kind of 1 over kappa. And I hope you remember that the k constant is 2 pi over the wavelength. So aside from that factor of 2 pi, which we're not going to worry about, this thing is the wavelength that we're throwing at it divided by the size of the bound state. And I hope it's also useful to remember that small size corresponds to high values of momentum, and therefore corresponds to high values of energy. Okay, so I think the book calls that quantity beta, just because they also get tired of doing it. Yes. So they're going to call this beta. And what we've discovered is that beta is, roughly speaking, the wavelength divided by the size of the bound state. And now we can finish this guy off. So what we've got is B is equal to I beta times A plus B. So if we rearrange this, we've got 1 minus I beta times B is equal to A. And remember, oops is equal to, what we're really interested in is B over A. Okay, so for short wavelengths, B over A is going to go to zero. So if we have high energy particles and we shine them through this delta function, most of them are going to go through. On the other hand, so this is high energy, which is to say short wavelength. On the other hand, if we have low energy, then we have long wavelengths, and then beta is going to infinity, and what we're going to have then is B over A is going to be minus I over I, which is minus 1. And that means we're going to get, when you square that, you're going to get 100% reflection. Okay, so 100% reflection for low energy particles hitting this delta function, and 100% transmission if high energy particles are going through this transition. And of course, in between things are going to be in between. Okay. If we were to make a plot of the magnitude of b squared over the magnitude of a squared as a function of energy, what we know is that at high energy these things are going to go through, and at low energy we're going to get 100% reflection. And another way of saying this is this kind of typical breakpoint is about where the energy is equal to the absolute value of the energy of the bound state. Questions? Well, at this point, there are kind of a couple of directions we could go. And I want to go a little way down the direction we're not going to go very far in. What happens if we have two delta functions? What sorts of wave functions can we have? And if you think about it, if these guys are far enough apart, we ought to be able to have a wave function that looks kind of like that, with discontinuities that are discontinuities in slopes. We also may have a solution kind of like this, where we have an anti-symmetric wave function.
Can you at least try to describe, like, qualitatively what these potential, like, I get that it is a delta function, but like, what is the delta function? Like, what is the potential, I guess, in respect to like a particle, you know, being in some sort of situation?
So you're saying what would be a physical approximation to it?
Yeah.
So it's a pretty crude approximation to, well, we could use it for any short-range force, and then the range of that force kind of depends on what our regions of interest are. So this is not a terrible approximation for considering how electrons would move around two nuclei, for example. So we could have symmetric wave function like that for a diatomic molecule like H2, or we could have an anti-symmetric solution like that. So any short-ranged force, roughly speaking, if you kind of close your eyes, short is in the mind of the beholder, we can think about it as being a delta function force.
Short-range attractive forces.
Yes. Incidentally, it's not much difficult to work these all with repulsive forces. Of course, then there's no bound state, but you can go through and work the reflection probability, and it works out pretty similar. You get 100% reflection at low energy and transmission at high enough energy. Well, if you've got two, why not have three? And it turns out if you have three and they're far enough apart, you do have the possibility of a function like that. You have the possibility of an odd function like this. And you have a possibility for one that alternates as it goes through every one of them. Okay, so this even-oddness continues on if we have enough potential in order to have more than one bound state. With just a single delta function, we only have one bound state, so we don't get these all these extra possibilities. But if you have multiple delta functions, you can start to build up things that that look like more and more complicated molecules. Okay. So we're not going there. We could figure out the energy of all of those cases. What's our next example is to kind of spread out that delta function. So instead of having all of this action at a point, let's make a finite square well. Right? So a delta function is infinitesimally small and infinitely deep. Let's make something that has a finite width and a corresponding finite depth. And it turns out that if this wave function is shallow enough, the only solution we're going to have is a symmetric solution. It's going to look kind of like that. Just like we only had one solution for the delta function. But if we have a deeper potential, then we can have more possible energy states. We can always have the symmetric state as the lowest energy state, but we can have additional states which are anti-symmetric and then symmetric again. But since the well is only finitely deep, that set of discrete energy levels is going to come to an end. And in the end, we'll also have a continuous spectra of particles that can be flying by. And we can ask the same sort of questions we've just asked. What's the reflection coefficient? If we shine particles in from this side, maybe interesting stuff is going to go along in the inside, but in the end, away from the well, we can only have reflection and transmission, and we can figure out what those probabilities are. And it's kind of got to work the same at the extremes of energy. It pretty much has to work the same way as the delta function. At high enough energies, we're going to get 100% transmission. At low energies, we're going to get 100% reflection. And again, classically, you always get transmission, right? Because there's no turning point. There are strong forces that exist only at these boundaries, but they're not strong enough to actually reverse the motion. There's no classical turning point. So classically, a particle would just go flying through. And that might make you worry whether classical mechanics is going to map up to quantum mechanics, where we would have reflection. And the story is that if we make these, and this is again someplace we're not going to go because it takes too much work. If you make these edges, instead of being sharp, if you make them smooth, then you do get something that's more like the classically suggested motion, that the thing goes right through. So it's the sharpness of the potential that's causing the reflections, not just the existence of the well. If you're looking for kind of a physical example to go along with this, kind of the usual example is the nuclear force. So the nuclear force really does go to pretty much zero when you're just a few Fermi meters outside of the nucleus. And when you're inside the nucleus, you're pushed as much one way as the other, so there's pretty much no net force on you. So for a proton that's bouncing around inside of a nucleus, it really only feels a directed force when it's near the edge, when there's more stuff pulling it back than vice versa. So it doesn't have a sharp edge, it does have a more rounded edge, but it's not a terrible approximation for how the nuclear force works. Again, with a very short distance scale on the order of 10 to the minus 15th meters. Now, in order to solve this problem, we're going to have to come up with kind of a new way of getting solutions. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to look kind of like a mess, and we're not going to have formulas the way we've had formulas for energies. We're going to have more like processes. And we're also going to have to really push, in order to get any sort of solution, we're going to really have to push the symmetry pretty hard. So we're now going to, instead of having this well going from 0 to L, we're going to have this well going through a symmetrical interval, and then we're going to be looking separately for even or odd functions. And I hope it's clear from thinking about what these differential equations look like, the case of any constant potential. And so we're going to get minus h bar squared over 2m psi double prime plus some constant potential, either 0 or some negative value, psi equals e psi. That is, psi double prime is equal to some number 2m minus over h bar squared times psi. Right, this is just a constant, positive or negative, depending upon whether the energy is more or less than that potential energy. So the solutions are either going to be trigonometric or exponential. So for, say, this solution, it's going to be exponential in this region, and it's going to be trigonometric in that region. And how do we match up these boundary conditions? Well, if you remember the stack of functions that we had, right? We had delta and theta and this function and that function. So before, we needed to have two derivatives generate a delta function. And now we're going to have two derivatives generate a step. And so the requirement is going to be that at these points, the wave function is continuous and the derivative of the wave function is continuous. Okay, so with what we just did, we were one step further up in this stack. And so there, the function had to be continuous, but the derivative was not continuous. So now we're down a step, so continuous psi and continuous psi prime are going to be required at that spot. Well, I don't want to go too far down this road. It's mostly for next time. Let's at least set up the requisite equations. So what we're going to have is a potential well. Question? Nope. So I'm going to choose the potential to be 0 outside of this well, and I'm going to have my boundaries at A over 2 and A. And I'm going to look at separately at two types of solutions, right? I'm going to look at solutions that are even and hence look like a cosine and then connect up with an exponential. Or at higher energies, I can have solutions that are odd and then connect up with an exponential. And the overall equation we've got, the one, same one that's written over there, is psi double prime is equal to minus 2m e minus the potential energy divided by h bar squared times psi. So in this region here, in the classically allowed region, there is some kinetic energy. And so the energy minus the potential energy is positive. And so this quantity is going to be positive. So we've got the differential equation here that psi double prime is equal to minus some positive constant times psi. On the other hand, in this region here, the potential energy is more than the energy. So we're going to have a negative value for this constant. So we're going to have the differential equation here that psi double prime is equal to plus, sorry, kappa squared times psi. Okay, so we're going to be matching up then the possibility that psi is some constant e to the minus kappa x. And here we're going to have the solution either that, let me call this something else like C. We're going to have either the solution that A is cosine kx or the solution where this is A times sine of kx, depending upon whether we've got a even or an odd solution inside. Now, it may be worth commenting, we do have two spots where we have to match the boundary conditions, but by the evenness or oddness, if I've made it work here, it'll automatically work there. So all I really have to do is concern myself with this one spot. Okay, so I think I'll quit there. We'll be set up for next time to find the solutions to these equations. And we're going to do it. In, I don't know, what may seem like a pretty funny way. So we're going to get in the end a transcendental equation where we have some trigonometric function is equal to some other trigonometric function that we can't solve by normal methods. We could feed it to Mathematica, and if you tell it what the values of A and H bar and V naught are, it could tell you what those solutions are. But it would be nice to have some sort of qualitative sense of what the solutions look like. So we're going to have a, as I say, a transcendental equation, kind of the form that f of k has to equal g of k. And what we're going to do is to graph f of k and g of k. Turns out that they look kind of like this. And then, of course, these intersections are going to give us the value. And I repeat, this may seem like kind of a strange way of going about doing it, but what I hope you will see as a result of all of this is, roughly speaking, what values of k work, how many solutions are there, and how the even and the odd solutions interleave the way they always have. And Mathematica, of course, could give you a numerical answer, but it can't kind of give you those general behaviors. So the reason we're going for the graphical approach is that it should give you some kind of qualitative understanding of how these things work. But in the end, if you want numbers, certainly Mathematica is the only way you're going to get solutions out. Okay, so of course, after we've done these bound states, then we're going to look at the transmission probabilities. And those are also kind of an algebraic mess, but not as bad as the bound state problems are.